everyone. I am your host, Jason Miles, and this is Revolution Podcast. For those of you that don't know, I have relocated. The show is now international. I probably said that. All right, accent is horrible. I apologize. The show is international. I relocated to Mexico. And one thing I'm finding is I'm having a ton of internet issues. So for the patrons who usually get the show a day early, I apologize on the delay in some of the audio-only uploads. I've been having a nightmare of a time. It's not just that I live in Mexico, it's that I live kind of in the cuts, like on a dirt road. So to say that there are infrastructure problems is a bit of an understatement. Just with the internet, everything else is working just fine. So I want to get that out of the way first. This episode is from the show we did on Thursday, the 11th of November, with freelance journalist Eamon Whalen. And if you saw the show, it was actually rather hilarious because Eamon was doing it in his basement. He had sadly just got COVID. He was isolating himself. And there were some pretty hilarious comments about the way his basement looked, like a serial killer's basement. And we poked a little fun at Eamon. But Eamon's been doing, all jokes aside, he's been doing some really great work reporting on the ground. Actually, in this show, we find this out, which kind of blew my mind. There was video, if you remember. So let me back up a little bit. Eamon is from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he reports mostly, you know, from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He also does work. A lot of bigger stuff. It's not just like he writes, you know, just in and for Minneapolis. But of course, you know, Minneapolis is the epicenter for a lot of the fiery protests that we saw in the spring and summer of 2020 during the lockdown. I think probably the most damage was done in Minneapolis when it comes to those uprisings, protests, whatever word you want to use. And he got the video of the mayor when the protesters were outside the mayor's house and asking the mayor, or demanding from the mayor. You know, when I say asking, it sounds like they were politely asking, demanding the mayor to totally abolish the police force, and he wouldn't do it. And I always thought that video was kind of interesting. And he was the one that actually took it. I did not know that. But he's been doing some actually really great work highlighting a lot of the organizers of a lot of the protests that we saw, who are now, I don't want to say pivoting away from direct action, but they are trying to implement an inside-outside strategy. And sadly, their candidate for mayor didn't win, but they did get a few of their candidates in the city council. And we get into the weeds on the show on why certain candidates didn't win and how certain districts are broke up and tactics that were used to kind of frighten voters away from any sort of legislation that would have called for truly defunding or making law enforcement looking very, very different in Minneapolis. And let's be reminded that George Floyd is not the only high-profile case of police murder in the Twin Cities. Philando Castile happens just a few years ago in, I believe, St. Paul. We talk a lot about that. And if you are a patron of the show, then you found out what we found out, that Eamon was a hip-hop writer, a hip-hop journalist, music journalist. And we have a very long hip-hop. I found it fun. I like talking about music in general, and finding out that he was a bit of a hip-hop journalist, we definitely got into a conversation about hip-hop and neoliberalism, and I wouldn't say a turn rap made, but there's a moment, in my opinion, where rap definitely becomes a sales pitch for lifestyle brands, in my opinion. And we got into that discussion as well. So if you're not a patron, would like to become one, it's easy. If you have the means and you feel so inclined and you would like to help and see the show grow, it's the best, easiest way to do it. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. That music means I've went too long. Wherever you're listening to the show, there's links in the description to all the social media so you can see it live. 6 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday Pacific time. Saturday, 9 a.m. Pacific time. And I am out. Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. I am your host, Jason Miles. I'm very excited for the episode that we have today because we are going to get into the weeds, if you will, on Minneapolis post George Floyd. And I always look at Minneapolis as kind of the centerpiece of what we saw with a lot of the protests in and around the world, actually. So we have with us a freelance journalist that's been covering Minneapolis. He's a native of Minneapolis. He's been covering Minneapolis for many years and has a great piece in The Nation. It should be linked in the description of the show. But before we bring him in, let me bring in my co-host, my homie, my dog. He is the man of the Mau Mau Hour. And he and I will be speaking at Oxford University tomorrow morning. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, brother.
Are you excited for the show today? I'm assuming that you have a plethora of questions ready.
I'm really excited to get into like the geopolitics, racial history, policing history of Minneapolis, big picture, small picture analysis, the election, all of it.
Are you excited about our speaking engagement tomorrow morning? It's morning for me. It's not, it's morning for you, but it's like 11 for you. It's 8 a.m. for me. Are you excited for this?
I'm very excited, as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, I'm going to prepare a kind of list of talking points.
Will you wear a tie?
I was actually going to ask you, how should we go with a tie for that?
I started wearing a button-up for our 2 week shows. And all my button-ups kind of are the trashy fucking plaid shirts. So they'll be lucky to get a trashy plaid shirt out of me. Those limey bastards. Okay,
I'm not going to wear a tie because that will be...
You should wear a tie. You should wear a tie. You'll look like one of Malcolm X's assistants.
I might wear a tie and a suit.
If you wear it, yes. We're gonna get a copy of this. We're gonna get video of this so we can see Pascal in a tie. So in the chat right now, let's take a vote. Should Pascal wear a tie? And at the end of the show, we'll count up the yeses and the noes. But I think
I got Pascal, no problem putting on a tie.
I think you should wear a tie. I think it'll be a wonderful look. We'll look like opposites. We'll look like the odd couple. Be so adorable. Well, let us play this. We'll say again.
It's at 11 tomorrow, right?
Your time is.
Gotcha.
How prepared we are, people. He's double checking the time with me. But let's play this clip. This clip kind of hard for me to make because I don't like watching snuff films. I call a lot of the things that we see ad nauseum on TV with the either police killings or vigilante killings, whatever it be, when you have to see it over and over again, it actually makes people very desensitized to the violence. During the Rodney King trial, when the prosecution of the officers, the prosecutor started playing the video first time, many people in the jury panel wept. A few months in to that same trial, those same weeping jury members were desensitized to the violence and just didn't, as we saw with their verdict. So there's something desensitizing with watching these images over and over. I don't like to watch them over and over again. And it, I did want to show Rodney King because I think he was a touchstone for my generation. I, of course, was born in the 70s. So all I know of Watts is what I've read. But Rodney King was very, very relevant. And it was a time where, would you say a movement was getting started around him or trying to?
I would say zeitgeist, not a movement.
Would you say it was just more rage, if anything else?
It was a lot of rage. Let's not forget, this was going on during the Bush presidency. So, yes. You know, he still had a lot of spillover baggage being affiliated with Reagan. So, you know. It was a lot of events.
And also, this is a moment where the left is pretty dead.
At the doorknob.
The end of the clip, the reason why I play Rodney King's speech at the end of the clip, that 90 seconds was like the most important 90 seconds maybe of the early part of the 90s. And he was made fun of pretty much for the rest of his life for Can We All Just Get Along? He never was a public speaker, nor did he ask to be the spokesperson for the riots. He was thrust into a position he was not comfortable for. And I think it plays well with what we're going to be talking about today. So here is the clip. Can you see it on the screen?
Has it started yet?
I know, but can you see it?
Yes.
My thing's all messed up on my end. Okay.
America. black people are treated much as the Vietnamese people or any other colonized people, because we're used, we're brutalized. The police in our community occupy our identity as a foreign troop occupies territory.
The summer of 2020 was an explosive moment in America. Not since the uprisings of the late 60s had we seen the country en masse light up in a wave of fiery protest. With a string of high-profile vigilante and police killings, the tipping point for people to take to the streets and demand justice was the murder caught on camera of George Floyd in Minneapolis. As bystanders stood by shouting for law enforcement officers to release deadly hold, kneeling on the neck of Floyd, his death became the catalyst for a movement to defund bloated police budgets, but to do away with them altogether. Promises were made by certain municipalities, but not much has been done in major metropolitan areas to change law enforcement. Did the defund abolish movement do enough to get their demands met? Are we stuck in the era where hashtags and trending on social media are confused with true policy change? With most of the country opening up, is this revolutionary moment gone? Can the activists that organize these radical protests pivot to electoral positions of power to enact real substantive change? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
All right. I guess that ended the video. There you go.
About that, we got disconnected from the connection for a second. You know, so
after all, I mean,
sorry.
I can understand the first upset for the first 2 hours after the verdict, but to keep going on like this, and to see the security guard shot on the ground, it's just not right. It's just not right, because those people will never go home to their families again. And I mean, please, we can get along here. We all can get along. We just gotta, you know. I mean, we're all stuck here for a while. Let's try to work it out. Let's try to beat it. You know, let's try and work it out.
All right. And on that note, let's bring in our guest. He is a freelance journalist out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he writes in several publications, even The Nation. Mr. Fancy Pants. He is Eamon Whalen. Give.
The two gentlemen of Oxford calling me a Fancy Pants.
Pascal, I'm gonna get off air because it looks like my connection's a little blurry. So do you have your first question ready? Pascal?
Oh. Yes, there we go. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you now.
Yes. I am ready to rock and roll.
Well, you wanna ask your first question?
My first question, Eamon. Minneapolis. And that, you know, you documented the events that brought us to George Floyd. Can you give our audience a kind of description of the political reality pre-George Floyd, of the politics, demographics of the particular area in which the George Floyd verdict and protest going in Minneapolis, for those who are not familiar with the area? give us a kind of view of what kind of environment we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I could do it. I mean, a general overview of Minneapolis. It's part of the Twin Cities with St. Paul. Both of them, Minneapolis is about 400, a little bit over 400,000 people. St. Paul is about 200,000. They're separated by the Mississippi River. The political context, I mean, it's generally, I mean, for especially for this conversation, the best way to put it is that Minneapolis is often touted as one of the best places to live in the country. High livability in the city council, city government really likes to tout that. But the underside of that that is often pointed out and especially has come under a lot of focus in the last 10 years, especially, has been that it's like got some of, it's got the worst racial disparities in terms of income, education, police brutality. It's the gap is quite wide. And so some people have said, I'm forgetting what quoted in an article, someone said like it's Wakanda for white people or something like that. Very Scandinavian sort of culture to it. So then broadly speaking, the pre-George Floyd, and the reason I think this will give context for why things transpired like they did, George Floyd was part of a series of high-profile police killings of Black men. There was, I mean, if you want to go, there was things in the 90s with someone named Tysel Nelson, but in 2013, there was someone named Terrence Franklin who was gunned down in a basement. And that case is actually going to be reopened, it looks like, because the cops were lying about their story and might get immunity. Then in 2015, there was a Black man named Jamar Clark who was killed. Sorry, I just saw the chat. I am in a dungeon, yes. Jamar Clark, who was killed in North Minneapolis. And that triggered a occupation of the fourth police precinct. So this is different than the one that burned. This is on the other side of the city. That was in South Minneapolis. This was in North Minneapolis. And that was an 18-day police occupation. I was there for a couple days. There was a lot of repression, you know, tear gas, mace, marking rounds, but it never got reached the boiling point as before. And the one also thing about that that is a little bit under known is that there was a couple white supremacist 4chan guys from like a weapons 4chan channel who came and shot up the protest, shot five dudes. No one died, but so that was sort of a precursor. That was in 2015. And then we have Philando Castile in 2017. That's in St. Paul. It's in a suburb of St. Paul called Falcon Heights, which is, it's right in the middle. Like it's very close. It's close enough to Minneapolis and St. Paul to be part of the Twin Cities. So and that led to some protests and ones that got pretty intense on the I-94 freeway in the summer of 2017. But as far as like Minneapolis politics go, Jamar Clark sort of set the stage for the 2017 election and defined a lot about the 2017 municipal elections was about police brutality and MPD. And then when George Floyd happened, that was like lighting this fuse. A lot of these, you know, a lot of people during the protests were citing this as we've been out here for Jamar Clark, for Philando, for Terrence Franklin. Yeah. And so that had a lot to do with it. And I can kind of leave it there for that sort of set the stage, but I think that was good to sort of know about those. And then none of those Jamar Clark's killers, the cops, were not charged. They're still in the force. And then of course,
the same with Castile, correct?
That went to trial for manslaughter and he got off as well. But then what makes it really egregious, and there's like a lot of dissonance, especially if you've kind of grown up in this era, is that in 2018, I wanted to say, in one of the nicest lily white parts of Minneapolis, like a couple blocks from this restaurant that I worked at for 6 years, there's a white woman, an Australian white woman who lives here, is married to a American guy, yoga teacher, blonde. She goes out in her alley, hears something, calls the police come and kill her. but it's a Somali cop.
It was the black guy.
And the Somali cop gets third degree murder.
Yes.
And then everyone
threw his ass under the bus.
And it's just like, it's, you know, it's just so clear, the double standard there. And so I think that had a lot to do with sort of setting the stage for that. Demographics of Minneapolis, it's about 20% black, 60% white. Largest urban American Indian population in the country. There's the largest Somali population outside of Somalia.
I was in your Somali hood in 2019.
Did you play a show there?
Yes, I did.
Wolf, Riverside, that's like the old hippie neighborhood that has now become.
It's called Wolf. Oh, what is the bar? It's got Wolf in the name.
I don't know if that was on the West Bank. I don't recognize that.
It was a bunch of Somalis there, and it was near some college campus.
Okay. And then like North Minneapolis, where the Jamar Clark police precinct occupation happened, that's like the heart of Minneapolis's black community, is like northwest section of the city, and then it's split with the Mississippi River, and northeast would be on the east side of Mississippi River. But where George Floyd was killed is on the south side, which is in the part of the south side that was historically black. It's now getting gentrified, so there is a black population there. It's just less so than North Minneapolis.
One of the things I always found fascinating when people talked about Minneapolis and Minnesota is that the political imagery that we have about the state, probably going back to Walter Mondale, is that it's this liberal bastion of open-minded kind of progressive thought, et cetera, so on and so forth. How does that translate into the actual governance of the city or the state? I know we've had your former wrestler president, governor that you had
Jesse
a while
Ventura.
Back. Jesse Ventura. So there are some deviations from that illustrious image of being some bastion of progressivism. But would you say that Minneapolis replicates a lot of blue state, blue cities in that there is this veneer of liberalism, i.e. Boston, i.e. New York, and parts of New Jersey. But when it comes to the realpolitik of governance on the ground, all the racial, class, and capitalist tensions that we see even in some reactionary red states become the actual governing norm in the area, as opposed to this charade of liberalism or leftism or progressivism that we hear of.
Yeah, I would think that's very well said. The image doesn't typically meet the reality, especially if you're black or poor or not part of the white upper classes. So, and I do think it's a microcosm of a lot of the failures of liberalism and contradictions of the Democratic Party. And especially when you get into Minneapolis city politics, I think in the last 5 to 10 years, this has gotten even more intense, but like rhetoric, the dissonance between rhetoric and action, like people are as liberal progressive rhetoric as you can get with very little action on things that would tangibly improve people's lives or keep the police in check or anything like that. So yeah, I think that you're really well stated and that it is one of the pinnacles. It does have, there's a history of sort of labor populism and farmer populism. I don't know that history as well, but like our Democratic Party is called the DFL, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And then we also have the like legacy of Paul Wellstone, who was like one of the more left Democrats in the Senate and Congress for many years, sort of like a more, I almost describe him as maybe like a more charismatic Bernie figure. I want to say I've heard that he was actually friends with Adolf Reed when he was alive, but Paul Wellstone is like who a lot of Minnesota liberals aspire to be, but very few, if any, come to that.
Died in a plane crash, wasn't it? A plane crash though?
Yeah, right before his election, and then Walter Mondale stepped in as a very old man to try to win with it like 2 weeks left or something like that.
Right. So let's get to the crux of the matter in terms of how the defund the police slogan or politics manifests itself coming into the last November, the November election we had last week in Minneapolis, which you write so eloquently about in your piece in The Nation. Can you set up exactly how the defund or abolish police discourse becomes politicized in Minneapolis in the wake of George Floyd?
Yeah. So I think it's helpful. So like I've sort of been calling, inspired by this show and you, Pascal, the last 16 months since the uprising. There's like 16, 17 months between the uprising and the election as the 16th month counter-revolution, basically.
Wow. I like that.
So we have to get shots fired for that one because Pascal should know that you're slowly seeping into the lexicon of journalism.
George Floyd is killed on May 25th. And then the third police precinct, which is where Derek Chauvin worked, which is not very far from where George Floyd was killed, that's burned down May 28th. And then I don't know if you remember when our mayor got shouted out of that protest.
I remember that so well. I probably watched that 47 times in a row.
You may have watched the video that I took. So I took a video of it, and that's like, it went crazy. You know, I had to turn.
That was your video?
Yeah.
That's your video where dude walks up looking like Steve Buscemi in that meme where he's like, I'm a young person too. And he walks up and they're like, are you going to defund the police? And he's like, no.
Yeah. So context for that protest, that was at the end of a protest that had come outside of his apartment. And that protest started, and that protest was premised on defunding the MPD run that was put on by a group called Black Visions. And the beginning of that protest was started at a park, and Ilhan Omar spoke and another elected official spoke, which was pretty interesting. That people don't really talk about, that was at the beginning of it. And so this was part of a weekend, it appeared, where Black Visions was trying to pressure politicians to adopt this. And so towards the end of the march, we end up at Jacob Frye's apartment. He comes out, he walks out, he's asked by the organizer, his name's Candace Montgomery, that he's going to, if he's going to defund the police, and if not, we're going to vote him out of office. And he says no, gets booed out. Parenthetically, that moment has now become his strong suit, what he actually thinks is one of his biggest, his best moments, because he faced up to the left and he didn't waver. And that's why a lot of people, and that's, he actually ran on that a lot of times in his stump speeches. He was running that, I don't fold under pressure from activists. And so then the next day, that's on June 6th, June 7th, the city council, 9 members of the city council hold a ceremony in a park in South Minneapolis called Powderhorn. That's not very far from where George Floyd was killed. And they say, we're going to end policing as we know it. Our police force is endemically racist. They're violent. They're going to, and we're going to, we're not sure what we're going to do yet, but we can't have them in here anymore. And that moment it was vague. And so they announced it as a veto proof majority, 9 members of the city council. So we had a strong city council system. That means if 9 out of 13, the mayor can't veto it. And so they say, we have this strong majority, we're doing this. And that caught, you know, made national headlines. And this is also a city council that was very resistant to lowering the police budget at all. There had been a lot of organizing around defunding the MPD pre-George Floyd in 2018. And this is stemming from the Jamar Clark stuff. And so people were trying to cut the budget, and the city council was very hesitant to do that. They were able to get the Office of Violence Prevention created, I think, in 2018, which is sort of like what people would try to have in this new Department of Public Safety, like a more robust Office of Violence Prevention. So the political aftershock of that was seismic. Like, they basically, all of that city council had then, all those submitters of the city council had a target on their back. Many of them immediately started walking back the claims, but I think in retrospect, I saw that as taking a claim that I did think had broad support. Not everyone in the protests was on defund the police, you know, but I think it did have broad support, and it took it from, you know, the movement space into the electoral parliamentary realm. And so then that city council, they tried to draft to change the, to put it in the charter, to do this, this take it to change the city constitution to have this new Department of Public Safety. Then an unelected commission, and that was going to be voted on in November 2020, an unelected commission blocks them from doing that. And then there is a citizen-led signature petition that then goes up to the elections in 2021, when the mayor's mayor's office is open, all 13 city council seats are open, and then they have this also an amendment that the Charter Commission puts out basically as a way to rein in the city council, that we're going to have a strong mayor now. We're gonna change from a strong city council system to a strong mayor system. And that is totally, and so what ended up being on the ballot with question two, which was called the Defund the Police Amendment, was a taking out something that had been put in the charter by the police. Well, it was put in by voters, but the police union campaigned on it really hard in 1961 to put a guarantee of police officers per, it's like 1.7 per 1,000 residents or something like that. And so they have that guaranteed written into the city constitution that they have a minimum amount of officers. So that gives them an insane political leverage when they're trying to do their staffing levels. And it creates a block that to explore other alternatives. So what that amendment would do was take that out of the charter, and then it would, you know, it said it would take away the police department and put it as a new Department of Public Safety that would be overseen by the city council instead of the mayor, because that's the mayor's only, that's the only part of his, like, it's a weak mayor system, so he gets the police and he can veto the budget. And so that's what it would do. And it was unclear. It was sort of like that was a step, and then potentially the next people who govern can decide what that Department of Public Safety was. But no cop was going to get fired. You know, there wasn't going to be, like, the city attorney sent out a memo saying that the union agreement is still going to be the same if this passes. No cop is going to lose their job if this passes. And then, so in the background of all this, since May 25th, there has been 300 officers who have left the MPD, and that's a third of their total force. And a lot of the other ones have basically just pulled back, and it's become like a very much blatant protection racket that they're saying, you know, you guys are mad at us, we're going to retaliate against you. And then a lot of them took disability retirement and are taking workers' comp, which is like starving the city budget. So you have that all going on while this amendment debate is going on. And then you also have a historic upsurge in crime, which gives the pro-cop position a ton of sort of grist to get the average voting public, which is going to be a lot different than the people who are were on the streets, you know, burning the third precinct. So that sort of sets this up.
I was actually interested in asking you if there had been a commensurate increase in crime in Minneapolis that we saw in some of the other cities. You already answered that question as well.
Yeah. It's a high uptick, and it became a totally law and order election. And the mayor, it was really like the power elite of the city was coming together to crush any possible change. It was like the police chief, he was appointed after that killing of the Australian woman, and he's like, you know, seen as the public as like the most redeemable cop in the force. He's a black dude. He's from Minneapolis. He sued the police when he was a cadet or like a young officer for discrimination. He tasked himself as a reformer. It's pretty much bullshit, but he's still pretty broadly popular. So basically the mayor put the chief as his running mate, the downtown business council, chamber of commerce, the local newspaper, everyone converged together in lockstep. Like, it was pretty amazing it's pretty amazing to see. And so, like, that was a lot to overcome and you
pause you for 1 second because I want to ask a question because I want to get some sort of context just for myself and maybe for the listening audience. So you're telling me after these massive protests happened in your city, which I think were probably the most devastating financially, if I'm not mistaken, just from the property.
That was the most property destruction since Rodney King.
And I'm not saying this as I'm a defender of burning down McDonald's, but I'm just saying McDonald's burned down, like the police.
I watched an Arby's burn down there's an Arby's right next to the precinct. The precinct is right by where I went to high school. So.
It was insane to see that level of destruction because much like the LA riots, when you get to a certain level of destruction, your message gets lost. Do you think because of the level of destruction, even though kind of sort of in the online community, we saw a bunch of write-ons and hell yes, but the reality on the ground seems to be extremely different if the same regime can take power, after this horrible incident. So is the feeling of the citizens just like we don't ever want this to happen again, so please give us more cops? Is that what the citizenry is kind of saying?
Sort of. I mean, there's definitely been a narrative that we're just a lawless city now, which is totally overstated. But I would actually say that for the most part, at least at the time, there was pretty much broad support. Like, it wasn't like support, but it was a kind of qualified, like, this is what you've done, because everyone had seen this be a big issue in the city for years with all of these police killing after police killing. And then nothing changes, and then it happens again, and it's like we're worldwide. And so most people were like across the board, like not super coming at, you know, rioters or looters. Like there wasn't a lot of that, but that was only in the first couple of days. But then there was a very interesting change of the narrative once it got out of control that weekend. Gotcha. Where basically after the precinct burned, and then things started to spread geographically out of that core part, spreading to St. Paul, all across the city, people just like smashing shit, grabbing shit. And that the governor gets on and he says, this is no longer about George Floyd. We now have hundreds of white supremacists that are coming into the city. And it's all outside agitators, and it became the sort of thing where it was
and that's where Hold My Blunt guy comes from, right?
Who's that?
Hold My Blunt guy. Remember that, where the guy is bashing the windows?
And the kid, I don't know if I saw that.
The kid walks up and was like, "Hey, dude, we're not here to destroy property. This isn't what we're here to do." And the guy just keeps bashing these windows with some sort of like rod or something, and the kid is trying to stop him. And then finally the guy's like, "Man, I'm gonna fuck you up if you touch me again." The kid, man, he's smoking a blunt. He's like, "Man, hold my blunt." And then the camera cuts off because he goes to fight.
No, I don't know if I saw that. But yeah, so there's definitely some of that, but I would say it was a lot of people who were like white and black people smashing shit together was probably more of the narrative. And I thought what that did was I don't want to say that was totally untrue, that there was like white supremacists coming in, but there was very little proof. Like there's very little like material proof. And there has been three Boogaloo boys who've been arrested, who are there, who are trying to like get in and do whatever their fantasy cosplay is. But there's become a narrative, especially around Democrats around the election, the presidential election, where they're like, it was the right wing who burned down the third precinct. And they're trying to act like the Boogaloo boys were like decisive in that. And there's just like, there's thousands of locals there. And they're trying to act like a couple people were decisive in making this precinct happen. But to go back to your question, I think now people associate, they remember the property destruction, and they've put away their BLM sign and whatever, you know, when they put away their Biden sign. I should you not. That happened in a lot. People, especially in the neighborhood I grew up in, people have had a Biden and a George Floyd sign. And then after Biden won, they, and that was part of kind of the counter revolution of that getting absorbed into the Democratic apparatus. But I think now people just associate that with the crime. They tie the sort of property destruction to this broader feeling of lawlessness and like, and they don't put it on like, you know, the cops aren't like, the cops are basically on strike, you know, like they're trying to punish us, and they don't think about police as having like their own political motives. That hasn't become enough of a narrative in this. So I would
it's never a narrative, and it's always a talking point, in my opinion, because that's the first thing you deal with in cities like Minneapolis, which reminds me of Oakland, which reminds me of West Philadelphia, which reminds me of Southside Chicago. And that's becomes the narrative of police. If you have a real problem and you do call police for any sort of help, the first thing they'll say is, well, you know, these guys are running around here talking about defunding the police. We don't have enough cops to get to your shit. Which
has happened
true.
In recent days, where it's been recordings of police telling people, and that I've heard many anecdotes like that, where the police have literally told people, like, talk to your council person. So it's really like a protection racket that they're running, but it worked.
I want to address a point that you made, Amon, that's very interesting to me that we don't talk about enough. And you said it, you kind of glazed right by it. You said how the Democratic Party apparatus absorbed the energy of the protests, particularly around the... I remember watching the Democratic Party's convention in the summer of 2020, I believe. And it struck me that they were using the messaging around these urban rebellions as a kind of anti-Trump, Trump is so racist, he turned us to have to burn our cities kind of vibe. And actually kind of, because they had like people who were Black Lives Matter protesters who were photoshopped in the convention. Because I was expecting them to have a much more hardline anti-rebellion, anti-riot kind of almost distancing themselves from that energy. But instead, it struck me that they were actually capitalizing on that moment of insurrection, if you want to call it thus, and using it as a means to drum up support, particularly amongst their Black voter base. Wow. I'd like to know your thoughts about that. If any of you guys kind of saw how that was kind of being cynically very much manipulated by the Democratic Party.
I didn't see them talking about sort of like the destruction and like burning as something they're trying to.
No, they didn't do it that way. They would highlight like people who would protest. They would talk about it in very social justice-y kind of.
Yeah. Well, you remember there was a moment there where it was like everyone was protesting, and then like Mitt Romney showed up to a BLM protest even, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, we've crossed the Rubicon!" Like even the Republicans are joining us, and that did all get a lot of it did get channeled, I think, into the election, into this anti-Trump thing, and especially when Trump was doing the stuff in Portland too. But yeah, I agree with that, and I'll say like again, the neighborhood where I grew up, which I had never seen a Black Lives Matter sign there. It's a Democratic neighborhood. It's, you know, it's a rich conservative on the Democratic sign, like rich people, but never seen a BLM sign. Mostly just Democratic candidates. After the precinct burn, you know. Many, you know, lawns across the city, but then, like I said, a lot of them came down afterwards. Like every business had one. Like it just became, it was omnipresent across the city. And then it, you know, arguably starts to lose its meaning if everyone is claiming George Floyd as a martyr. You know, so, and then I would say on the. Mostly people just don't even like to talk about, the Democrats here just don't even like to acknowledge the level of destruction that happened. And I think that's why they like to say that the right wingers did it, because they don't want to face the facts of like what the decades of bad governance, disinvestment has done and what that people were ready to do.
One of the things I wanted to ask you again also is that I read in the New York Times, they did a really great article about what happened in the election, and they actually painted the election as a class color divide. Basically, they were saying, according to the polling results, that in the black working class communities, they were completely, almost unanimously against defund, abolish the police type of ballot measures. While in the more educated, affluent suburbs, those measures did better off. Is that actually an accurate depiction of what happened?
There's a kernel of truth to that, and I saw that op-ed, and I was very like, so that was by a woman named Nikema Levy Armstrong. She ran for mayor in 2017, and was like a law professor, and is a big time police activist. But a lot of people have critiques of her as having pretty conservative politics and actually being pretty friendly with the police. And that's what I saw a lot in that article, was she just kind of did the same sort of liberal, like, this is actually what we need to do to with police. But I will say that there is definitely some truth to black people in North Minneapolis not feeling like they were engaged with it and feeling like other people don't have to deal with our reality, especially referring to crime, but also police brutality. But there was very cynical ways that black proxies for the police were being used to say that black people don't want this. And then that actually, I think, bled into white liberals saying, justifying it to themselves by saying, oh, black people don't want this. But I will just tell you, like, so I have like a little bit of data. So it's Ward 4 and 5 are the two wards in North Minneapolis. Those wards had, Ward 4 had 4,633 no on two votes, and Ward 5 had 3,306 no on two votes. That's very, very low participation. The total population of both those wards are about 33,000 each. So they had about 3,000 to 4,000 people vote no out of the 34,000 population of the ward. Versus Ward 13, Southwest Minneapolis, where I used to work, richest, most lily white place, which is what Nikema was kind of trying to say, is that they're the ones that actually supported it. They had 12,000 no votes. So they had double the other ones combined. And so there was, and then the other ward where I live, where I grew up, Ward 7, the other ward that these wards, Ward 7 and Ward 10, have the biggest turnout. They tend to decide the mayor. That's why the mayor is more, tends to be more conservative, because he's from, you know, draws voters from the ward. Ward 7 had 7,000 no votes. And so, like, out of the total number, like, they try to make it like the black vote was decisive, or the North Minneapolis vote was decisive, but it was about 10,000 no votes of 80,000 total, if you're assuming everyone in those wards who voted was black, which isn't, because they're not fully, it's Minneapolis, even black neighborhoods have white people living in them, you know, they're not.
What was the overall vote percentage that favored the defund measure?
It was 56 to 44. So
44.
That favored to not defund the police, or favored to defund the police?
Favored to not do this charter amendment that was. So this is the other thing, is that there is so much disinformation from the opposition saying that this is going to abolish the police in 30 days. That was the talking point sent out by the mayor's PAC. And in the article that I written, not for The Nation, but for Belt Magazine, where I followed some canvassers in North Minneapolis who were talking to people at the doors about the amendment. I'm not trying to make it up. Every person thought initially, oh, that's the one. No, we need some cops. That's crazy. And then they would explain what it was, and they'd be like, oh, that sounds more like common sense. But there was just so much inertia. There was so much inertia going in the direction of no, that I was actually kind of, I thought it might've been more of a blowout. It's kind of hard to say. You could sort of spin it either way. You could say, well, 44% still voted yes. Like, maybe the political establishment isn't that strong. Other people are acting like it's a resounding defeat. I think and then some of the organizers are taking it as a victory. And I think they should maybe have a little bit more self-reflection about why there was majorities in those black areas that didn't vote for it. Like, that part is true. It just wasn't like as significant and decisive as people are saying.
Would you say this? This is my problem. This is my problem with kind of the contemporary online left. you know what, let's say left. Let's not put people in little bitty categories. Any defeat feels like a massive defeat. And no one seems to understand that, even as Pascal and I constantly ad nauseum bring up a 50-plus year counter-revolution, that was not an overnight. Barry Goldwater, who is the Palpatine, if you will, of the right-wing counter-revolution, loses the presidential election in 64. And yep. A Republican doesn't take office until Reagan in 1980. So years of defeats and retreats, and it was a Democrat-controlled.
We had Nixon in 68, but he wasn't that. He wasn't Nixon, Barry Goldwater.
I mean,
was Nixon a Barry Goldwater clone like Reagan was?
No, not at all.
It's entirely. I mean, it's. I would even say it's likely that there will be fruits of this moment amongst that we'll see down the line, because what we're seeing now was the fruits of what happened a couple of, you know, with these past struggles over it that produced a lot of the I don't know, public opinion, movement infrastructure, just kind of like momentum towards that. So it very well could, but you know, I think if they would have had the question in the November 2020 election, which would only have been a couple months mm-hmm. after that happened, it would have passed. But people had enough, they then postponed it to have enough to run their 16-month counter-revolution and to cast enough doubt in people's minds and spend enough money. And then, you know, the like I said, like the voting base is a lot different than the base of the people who are in the streets. So it's going to be not a perfect reflection of that.
One of the things that I'm concerned with those who are in the movement community who are saying that 44% voting in favor of the defund measures is a victory, is that I would argue that that could be said if we were in a prevailing political position where progressive reform politics were actually carrying the sails at this moment. I don't think that's the moment. I think that the Democrats and the left are in retrenchment, and the reactionary right is actually at a moment where they are becoming ascendant in terms of the actual ideological superstructure of American society. So I think that we might be moving in a direction where these kind of, you know, progressive sounding measures of police reform are going to be shouted down as the reactionaries increase in their march forward to try to gain palpable political power.
Yeah, so we even saw that, and this is kind of, you can get into the city council races. So like I said, all 13 of the city council seats were open, and everyone who was on the stage who did the pronouncement of we're going to disband the police had a right-wing challenger, and a couple of them, it was actually like Republicans that were registering as, like Keith Ellison's son, his main opponent, he's a city councilman in North Minneapolis, and his opponent was like, one of his main opponents that he ended up just squeaking it out for was a guy who was like well known to be a Republican, like pastor, who was like anti-LGBT and pro-life and stuff. And it was like very much like that is not, like Minneapolis is just different shades of Democrats and then like some green parties and socialists. So people were able to use the rise in crime and then the polarization around defund to smuggle in politics that were uniquely right wing for the environment. And so with the results of the election, like if you look at those nine city council people, two just decided I'm done with politics. I'm not going to run next year. Their seats are now filled by DSA endorsed candidates. Another guy who is the Green Party, he got beat by independent socialist Robin Wansley Warlaba. And then three of the other ones got absolutely rinsed by pro-police people. And so this has a lot to do with the particular politics of the ward. And
I was
like,
gonna ask about the districts where
like one guy who was in a more rich part of the area, like got smoked, like he was too progressive for that area probably. Another guy, Steve Fletcher, who is sort of like downtown-ish, he got beat by a guy who was like the least charismatic, just part of kind of like a political dynasty family. And then a woman named Latricia Vita beat this guy named Philippe Cunningham in North Minneapolis. And she was like, she said on a landlord Zoom that like, basically, landlords, you just tell me what to do and I'll say whatever you need to say. And she's like, we actually, you know, wow. We were like very pro cop. Like, so there was a big, like concerted, organized right wing slate of candidates. Some of them were successful. There wasn't like a clean sweep, but then we also have the presence of these three DSA candidates who are part of wards that are like, they're not all bordering each other, but they are wards that where a lot of the property destruction happened, and where like the Ward 9 where George Floyd was killed, that went very much for yes. And that still has a black population. And that also elected Jason Chavez, who's in my article, who's Democratic Socialist.
That was, yeah.
Ward 10, which is like uptown, that elected Aisha Chugtai, who's the youngest elect council member ever. She's 24. And then Robin, who I mentioned, who is she's actually unique in that she didn't seek the DFL ballot line. She just ran an independent socialist campaign and won. And I was very impressed with all of them, but I would say especially Robin. And so they were all, and so it looks like, and so the other thing I should say is rent control was on the ballot. Rent control passed. And rent control passed in the areas, a lot of the areas where question two didn't pass, in North Minneapolis, in Silver Riverside, where the heavily Somali community is. And then it passed everywhere where the yes vote was strong. So where I see is that there is a broad majority for like left policies, public goods policies, but there was a problem with how question two is communicated, how people are relating to defund, you know, whatever you want to call it. And that they just need to be won over to that. That's where I saw kind of comparing the yes on two map versus the rent control map. I was actually pretty heartened.
It's interesting though, as we're talking about, you know, these victories that are won or moving the quote unquote Overton window for people to look at policing a little differently. I think across the board, if you were to ask people how they view certain police interactions, wasn't there a person that you wrote about that was running to have police in like 2017 to not be armed at every interaction?
Yeah, that was like the candidate, the left candidate in 2017, and that just like totally buried his campaign.
And I think what really kind of shook me about, and this is more the Twin Cities, was Philando Castile. And it shook me to my core because I figured that that was going to be the moment that the right wing of like, you know, the NRA wing could get behind some of the anti-police rhetoric, because a lot of those people are anti-establishment libertarians, because he was a licensed gun carrier. And they didn't get behind him like I thought they would.
They didn't get behind the Panthers in the 60s either.
No, that was the 60s. This is, what, 2018, when that poor man got murdered by that cop?
He was still black.
Yeah. I mean, Pascal, you act as if there's not black people carrying water for the NRA. There's black sheriffs in nearby Milwaukee carrying crazy water for the NRA.
Remember when Killer Mike did that ad for
Killer Mike loves the NRA. That's what I'm saying. I mean, there's black folks carrying water for the NRA.
Did you watch? I remember when Dana Loesch was doing those ads. Their ads are like trying to spark a race war, basically.
I have a clip. One of my clips, I have a Dana Loesch thing in one of my clips. I can't remember which one it was for, but she's so
I should just add on the city council note, while it's great that we have these three socialists, the strong mayor amendment, that also passed. So they're going to be historically disempowered. And like the mayor's he's consolidated all the governing power in his office. So he's the biggest winner, I would say, of this election, is Jacob Frey, who won by like, he won pretty convincingly, because the main, you know, candidate opposing him didn't have great name recognition, and was like, you know, could be very much tied back to police abolition. But she did, she got like 25%, which was better, or 21%, which was better than I was expecting. But yeah, he's the main winner. He's very much in the Mayor Pete, Beto, Eric Garcetti, Justin Trudeau mold.
Oh, neoliberal.
Neoliberal, but like soaring rhetoric, young and energetic, very, very ambitious, totally spineless, except when he's standing up to the left, like we saw in that famous video, which I saw. I watched the Chamber of Commerce did like an election wrap up, and I watched like the local Chamber of Commerce, and they were saying like that was his best moment, was standing up to that activist group, and that's why he won. That was their takeaway, is that he won because he showed he was consistent by saying that he's not going to do that, which I thought was a pretty interesting takeaway.
I wouldn't say I was shocked that he won, but I when I saw that he won, I wanted, and I want to talk, you're joining us for the bonus patron.
For sure.
Okay. I do want to ask you about that, about the mayor winning and what did that do to the left movement that was going on. And I also want to ask you about, you talk about in your article that a lot of the people that were involved in the uprisings in the spring were not part of any sort of political affiliation. It wasn't like the DSA chapter was going crazy and a bunch of quote unquote Antifa was going crazy. It was like just regular rank and file people in the streets that were pissed off.
Yeah. There was maybe like DSA members and members of groups, but this was like, I witnessed it. It was like on a Facebook thread of a local activist where someone was kind of talking about like, this is a left uprising. And he was like, this was not a leftist uprising. This was a poor people's uprising. You know, there wasn't any groups signaling themselves as being like on the ground. Yeah. This was just people sick of the shit going at it basically.
And I want to talk to you about
that. That seems broadly true for what I would.
But I want to get into that, and I'm excited to see how Pascal even gets deeper into this question. Is how did the organizers and the left take advantage of this situation, or were they not able to take advantage of this situation, as we see with the mayor winning? I want to get into that in the bonus patron half. If you guys are not patrons, it's easy. Patreon.com/BetterLake Presents. You get all the bonus content. Oh. Sorry about that. I have no idea who's calling me. And Pascal, you ready?
Yes, yep.
Eamon, you ready?
Indeed.
Okay, and we are out.